Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church, Episode 16, Gallic Pogrom. In 175 AD, a revolt broke out in the Eastern Empire under the leadership of the Roman legate of Syria, Avidius Cassius. For the full details of the civil war, see Episode 94 of the History of Rome. For our purposes here, it is suffice to say that Marcus Aurelius was victorious and the usurper was defeated. As a result, the emperor took his family on an imperial tour throughout the east to reestablish support among the provincials. In the summer of 176, Marcus was passing through Asia Minor, and by autumn, he was in Greece, showing off his clemency and goodwill to his subjects. Seeing an opportunity, no less than three Christian apologists wrote to the emperor himself, hoping to get on the Augustus's good side and improve conditions for Christians. Two of these apologists were also prominent Orthodox players in the contemporary Montanus controversy: Claudius Apollinaris of Hierapolis and Melito of Sardis, both of whom we discussed last week. The last apologist was an Athenian Christian named Athenagoras. All three apologists stressed the essential harmony that existed between Christianity and the Roman Empire. Obviously, the apologists wanted to present Christians as loyal subjects. Apollinaris made the bold claim that the famous rain miracle during Marcus's wars against the Germanic barbarians was the result of the prayers of Christian legionaries. When Marcus Aurelius was campaigning along the Danube against the Germans, the 12th Legion had run out of water. Soon, they were surrounded by barbarians, and all hope seemed lost. But then a storm struck, rain came pouring down, and the legion had water again, enabling them to fight and defeat the enemies of Rome. For more info on the event and the war as a whole, see Episode 93 of the History of Rome. The story was widely circulated and was depicted prominently on the victory column Marcus later erected. Naturally, various pagan authors claim this or that deity had responded to the legion's prayer and saved the Romans. Apollinaris decided to Christianize this, telling the emperor that it was the Christian God who had protected his soldiers. The apologists even claimed that the 12th Legion was composed entirely of Christians. This obviously was not true, but it probably reflects the fact that there were Christians in the imperial army. Obviously, these Christian soldiers were loyal to Rome and its emperor, a fact that suited Apollinaris' apologetic purposes very well. Melito of Sardis connected the rise of the church with the prosperity of the empire. Melito pointed out how the peace Augustus Caesar had brought coincided with the birth of Jesus. All past emperors, minus Nero and Domitian, were protective of Christianity, and as a result, their reigns were full of prosperity and success. Melito, of course, was, like Apollinaris, manipulating history for apologetic purposes. The so-called protection he spoke of was not legal recognition of the church, but the don't ask, don't tell policy of Trajan and Hadrian. Melito was prompted to write because of new persecuting decrees that had entered Asia, which we mentioned last episode. Pagans had taken advantage of these laws to plunder and rob Christians by acting as informers, something Trajan and Hadrian had forbidden. Melito was, as are modern historians, uncertain if these decrees were from Marcus Aurelius himself or issued by the local government. If they did indeed come from the emperor, then Roman policy towards Christianity was changing for the worse, permitting the anonymous informers and mobs to act against Christians with legal sanction. The last apologist to address Marcus during his eastern tour was Athenagoras of Athens. Athenagoras was particularly focused on refuting three common charges made against Christians: atheism, cannibalism, and incest. Atheism was the most common charge. Cannibalism may have been the result of pagans misunderstanding the Eucharist, and incest perhaps was the result of Christians, regardless of their kinship, referring to fellow believers as their brothers and sisters in Christ. Christians were not atheists, Athenagoras asserted, because they believed in the one true God. They simply refused to accept the gods of Rome, or any other pagan nations. Christians were not cannibals. In fact, they valued human life more than the pagans, who adored the gladiatorial games and freely exposed their own infants. Christians, by contrast, consistently saw these things as terrible sins. Finally, Christians did not commit incest, but instead they held the highest views of chastity and sexual morality. So, did these three apologists have any luck in convincing the wise and benevolent Marcus Aurelius to treat them more justly? Were their arguments able to strike a chord with the philosopher king? In short, no, not at all. And this is confirmed by two pieces of evidence. In the 11th chapter of his book, The Meditations, Marcus actually does mention the Christians. It is clear from this brief notice what the emperor really thought about the faithful. I think scholar Robert Grant puts it best when he says, quote, "In Marcus's view, the Christians are tragic in the sense that they are immature and insincere. It's hard to imagine an apologetic that could change his mind," unquote. Grant, Greek apologist of the 2nd century, 78. But the most damning example of the emperor's dislike of Christianity is the fact that he chose to give legal approval to the execution of nearly 50 Christians. In the summer of 177, in the city of Lyons, or Lugdunum as it was known then, in Gaul, modern-day France, one of the most horrific anti-Christian pogroms took place. Exactly when Christianity came to Gaul is not certain, but it clearly came from Asia Minor. The churches of Lyons and Vienna likely began as small communities of Christian traders from Anatolia. Many of the members of the Gallic churches had distinctively Asiatic Greek names. The communities, despite their great geographical distance between them, maintained close ties. The primary source for the pogrom is a letter written by the Gallic churches to their brothers and sisters in Asia. Most of the Christians in Gaul were Orthodox, but not surprisingly, there were Gnostic sects as well. The two cities Christianity was present in were Lyons and its southern neighbor, Vienna. Though these two prominent Gallic cities were civil rivals in the pagan world, the respective churches were incredibly close to one another. Gaul itself by this point was fairly Romanized. Gallo-Roman patriotism expressed itself in devotion to the Roman gods and to the emperor. This, therefore, did not endear the locals to their atheistic and impious neighbors. What exactly started the violence is not known, but in his book, Martyrdom and Persecution in the Early Church, W.H.C. Friend makes a plausible suggestion. Earlier that year, Marcus Aurelius and the Senate decided to permit the Gallo-Roman aristocracy to gather victims for the gladiatorial games from condemned criminals. The icing on the cake was that the aristocracy only had to pay one-tenth of the normal price for a gladiator. It is possible that some of the noblemen in Lyons saw this as an opportunity to harness popular anti-Christian sentiment to boost their popularity while also saving some money. Friend, page 5. We don't know, but whatever caused the violence to begin, once it started, boy, was it gruesome. It began after the local governor had temporarily left, with various restrictions being made against Christians in public life. The faithful were barred from houses, baths, and the forum. Among the oppressed Christians, many strong examples of faith and courage stood up for their community, so much so that they were remembered as pillars of the faith. The pagans harassed, verbally abused, beat, dragged along the ground, plundered, stoned, and imprisoned them. Finally, the Christians were rounded up and brought to the public forum to stand before the local magistrates. The believers confessed their faith, and the pagan magistrates waited for the governor's return before proceeding. When the governor did return, a prominent young Christian named Vettius Epagathus angrily stepped forward. Though young in age, Vettius was a holy and righteous man, obeying the commandments of Christ, devoting himself to the Lord, and serving his neighbors. He boldly asked the governor to let him speak, so he could demonstrate that there was nothing unlawful or wicked about the Christian faith. But the governor would have none of it, and the crowd drowned out Vettius' voice. The governor simply got straight to the point and asked Vettius if he was a Christian, to which he responded, "I am." Upon his confession, he was immediately imprisoned to later suffer martyrdom. The remaining Christians were then prepared to be tested for the games. Many of them were eager and ready for martyrdom, confessing their Christianity with great enthusiasm. But others were afraid and reluctant, and as many as 10 people actually apostatized, causing great sorrow to the rest of the brethren. These persons were still arrested, nonetheless, in order to be questioned on the alleged crimes Christians committed, i.e. cannibalism and incest. As more and more Christians were imprisoned, many among them began to worry, not about the torture that awaited them, but if they would be able to stand firm until the end, or if they would give in to the devil's machinations and renounce the one true faith. As July rolled on, more and more Christians were seized by the fanatical mobs, both local Christians in Lyons and believers who had come from nearby Vienna. In order to, quote, prove that the Christians really did commit cannibalism and incest, pagan slaves of Christians were publicly interrogated and made to testify against their monotheistic masters, a measure usually reserved only for people accused of treason. Many slaves confirmed the lies the magistrates wanted to hear, and the crowd became more incensed. To them, it was ironclad proof of their worst fears about Christians. Even pagans who had developed friendly relationships with Christians now turned on them and joined the mob in crying for their blood. Soon, many Christians were being tortured in horrific ways so they would confess the truth of their alleged crimes. The pagans were particularly infuriated by the indomitable conviction of 4 specific Christians. Sanctus, a deacon from Vienna, a recent convert of nobility named Maturus, Attalus, an Asiatic from Pergamum, and a small young slave girl named Blandina. Blandina's mistress, another imprisoned Christian, feared her servant would give in to the torture because she was so small and frail. But Blandina proved to be a perfect example of the fact that what men find weak, God finds glory in. Blandina was tortured morning and night, but she endured it all and even wore out her torturers, all the while confessing, "I am a Christian. We do nothing to be ashamed of." Both the crowd and the believers were amazed at the courage and strength she held, even after her small body had been horribly mangled and broken. Sanctus the deacon continued to outrage the pagans. Despite all the tortures they laid upon him, he would not give in, even after they fastened red-hot brazen plates to certain areas of his body. He refused even to tell them his name, ethnicity, or where he was from. Whatever the governor asked him, Sanctus simply responded, "I am a Christian." Sanctus was tortured so brutally he could no longer make use of his limbs. So a few days later, when he was brought to be tortured on the rack, the pagans believed that he would break right away. But instead, Sanctus recovered on the rack, his limbs came back to him, and his body became upright again, much to the chagrin of the heathens. One of the apostates, a woman named Byblis, was ordered to confess blasphemies against the other Christians. But as she was being tortured on the rack, she relapsed from her unbelief, remembering the fires of the next world. She indignantly refused to admit Christians were cannibals and became ever strong in her faith. And so, Byblis was martyred. After the torture devices had failed to produce the desired results, the Christians were stuffed into the darkest and foulest regions of the local prison. So terrible were the conditions that some suffocated and died, Many young Christians also died from the prison conditions, their frail bodies unable to endure. Yet others were tortured to the point that it seemed impossible they would keep living. But nonetheless, these confessors survived, drawing strength from their heavenly master. At last, the bishop of Lyons, Pothinus, was brought before the magistrates. The bishop was over 90 years old, sick, and suffered from respiratory problems. The governor asked the bishop, "Who is the God of the Christians?" Pothinus boldly responded that if the governor was worthy, he would know. Immediately, the old man was viciously attacked, dragged, and beaten, while onlookers hurled anything they could get their hands on at him. Barely alive, the Bishop of Lyons was locked away in the prison, where he died 2 days later. Among the imprisoned, those who had apostatized were beaten and punished severely for the non-existent crimes they admitted to. The others, who had simply confessed their Christian faith, received less torture. When they were led out of the prison to the public again, the contrast between the two groups was dramatic. Those who had held firm were jubilant and happy, while the apostates were downcast and melancholy. The other Christians who saw this were encouraged, and many more became willing to die for their faith. Maturus, Sanctus, Blandina, and Attalus were led out into the amphitheater to meet their end at the jaws of wild beasts. These games were probably connected to the worship day in honor of Augustus Caesar and the cult of Rome, which took place on August 1st. Maturus and Sanctus were once again tortured with whips before being mauled by wild beasts in the arena. The two men endured every torture the heathen crowd clamored for, culminating in iron chairs designed to burn their flesh. Yet despite all this, Sanctus remained completely silent. The only words he uttered were, "I am a Christian." The pagans were unable to overcome their resilience. Maturus and Sanctus continued to live a little longer before finally expiring and winning the glorious crown of martyrdom. Blandina was next, and she was hung on a pole to be devoured by the animals, but for some reason they would not touch the young girl, and so she was hauled back to the prison to be executed another day. Other Christians, waiting for their turn, watched their young sister in Christ. On the pole, she looked like she was on a cross. In the person of Blandina, the confessors saw the Lord. Attalus of Pergamum was next. The crowd hated him most of all, for he was a man of high standing. The nobleman was paraded around the arena with a sign that read in Latin, "This is Attalus the Christian." But before the pagans could satisfy their bloodlust, the governor was made aware of the fact that Attalus was a Roman citizen. Attalus was quickly sent back to the prison, while the governor wrote to the emperor, asking Marcus Aurelius how he should proceed. The wait that followed proved to be beneficial for the Christians. Many of those who had apostatized were greatly encouraged by the martyrs and came back to the Christian faith, confessing their religion to the persecutors. Attalus even noticed how the rigorous asceticism of one confessor, who kept denying food and drink offered to him in prison, was setting a bad example for the others. Attalus corrected him, and the man began accepting bread and water, giving thanks to God. At last, at the end of June, Marcus Aurelius' reply was received by the governor. The emperor stated that Roman citizens were to be beheaded. The remainder were to be used as food for the beasts on August 1st, during the festival of Augustus in Rome. Those who recanted their Christian faith were to be immediately released. The governor led the confessors to the arena, making quite a show of it in the process. The punishments the emperor had prescribed were carried out. Romans were beheaded, and provincials were martyred in the arena. However, the pagans were suddenly confounded by those who had previously denied their faith. Were they not about to release these people, and now they were all of a sudden eager to die? The governor had them all interrogated individually. Some did indeed finally leave Christianity and were set free, but many others were more steadfast than ever. A certain Christian physician named Alexander, known to the brethren for his grace-filled speech, came to the confessors and encouraged them. The crowd saw this and became incensed, as though Alexander was the sole reason the confessors had returned to their Christian faith. And so, Alexander, after confessing his Christianity, was ordered by a fuming governor to be sent to the beasts. The following day, Alexander was led into the arena with none other than Attalus, the Roman citizen. This was not a legal thing to do. Attalus should have been beheaded, but the governor was compelled by the mob to send him to the beasts. Their hatred of Attalus burning, their unrelenting desire to see him suffer, regardless of his Roman citizenship. Alexander and Attalus were then subjected to all the tortures the amphitheater could offer. But Alexander, right up to his death, made no sound, no wince, no cry, not even a groan. Attalus, as his body was seared on the iron chair, looked up to the crowd as the stench rose off his melting flesh, and exclaimed that they, the pagans, were eating men by doing this, while Christians committed no such deed. Before he died, Attalus was asked what the name of God was, to which he responded, "God has no name like a man." On the last day of the games, Blandina, the young slave girl, was once again led out to the arena, along with a 15-year-old Christian boy named Ponticus. In the days the two of them had been in prison, watching their loved ones be martyred, the persecutors were constantly trying to make them swear by the gods of Rome, but it was of no avail. Any pity normal people would have for a young boy and a young woman was lost on the heathens, outraged at the confessor's defiance. Once again, every torture was used against them. Ponticus prevailed until death, though, constantly encouraged by his sister in Christ. Finally, it was Blandina's turn. I will quote from the Epistle of the Gallic Churches the passage that describes her martyrdom. "Last of all, like a noble mother who had encouraged her children and sent them before her in triumph to the king, blessed Blandina herself passed through all the ordeals of her children and hastened to rejoin them, rejoicing and exulting at her departure as if invited to a wedding supper, not thrown to beasts. After the whips, after the beasts, after the griddle, she was finally dropped into a basket and thrown to a bull. Time after time the animal tossed her, because of her hope and sure hold on all that her faith meant, and of her communing with Christ. Then she, too, was sacrificed, while the heathen themselves admitted that they had yet never known a woman to suffer so much or so long." This passage is from Williamson's translation of Eusebius, Book 5, Chapter 1, verses 53 to 56. Though Blandina was the last to be martyred, the bodies of the dead Christians were then subjected to grossly disrespectful treatment. Even in death, the martyrs enraged the mob. The bodies were thrown to dogs, torn, mocked, and finally burnt after 6 days. The pagans jeered at the corpses, saying, "Where is your God?" Even as the mob's hatred began to die down, the surviving Christians were prevented from burying their holy dead. The ashes of the martyr were thrown into the Rhone River, never to be seen again. The pagans claimed this was a victory over the Christian doctrine of bodily resurrection. In the course of about a month, from early July to early August, at least 48 Christians were martyred in Lyons. On the blog, I have posted a picture of the remains of the amphitheater where the martyrs dined. Despite the claims of the persecutors, though, the Christians of Gaul viewed the pogrom as a victory. The devil had raised up a mob to try and make all the believers renounce Christ but they had stood firm. The martyrs of Lyons and Vienna stand out as a prime example of the Orthodox attitude toward martyrdom. They were humble, strong, willing, and patient. They did not actively provoke the authorities like Rigorous, though many were bold in the face of pagan hatred. They prayed, like Stephen before them, for their persecutors, and strengthened their fellow Christians. Before their deaths, the martyrs refused to even be called martyrs, which literally means witness, but instead claimed that they were merely confessors, people who suffered for the faith. Only those who had died were true martyrs. The violence had run its course, and eventually things would return to normal for Christians in Gaul. At some point during the pogrom, the Church of Lyons had heard about Montanism and dispatched a presbyter to carry a letter to Rome detailing their opinions on the new prophecy. The Gallic Christians were not in favor of Montanism and came down on the side of their Orthodox brethren in Asia. The presbyter who brought the letter to Rome was named Irenaeus, and upon his return to Lyons, he was made bishop. Irenaeus of Lyons will be a central figure very soon in our story, as he was arguably the greatest Christian theologian of the 2nd century. Next episode is unfortunately going to be like episode 15, not much in the way of a unifying event, but another series of vignettes we get from the fragmentary historical record. Nonetheless, the 2nd century is coming to a close, and the church will be standing tall at the end, with many incredible accomplishments. Thank you for listening. Please comment, review, and subscribe. If you have questions or thoughts about the show, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. And be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and the website, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com. Thank you.